Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. Now we're going to finish out the final part of Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy, the extended editions, with Return of the King. So let's jump right into the last installment. Return of the King extended edition opens with Sméagol, I think it's Diagol is the other character, opening. And at one point I thought they were brothers. I went back to the book and they are not. Diagol was his friend. They were not brothers. They seem very brotherish in the film, and I don't think it's stated what they are. It's kind of implied. But anyway, you know, the one thing that impresses me with this opening is just think about how hardcore a scene this is. We're in an epic action-adventure film series, ostensibly, right? And the last and final volume of the film trilogy opens up with a really creepy horror film-like murder, you know? And it's not pulled. It's not fake. It's not, you know, it's really more, again, you're going to hate me for saying this for the umpteenth time, but, you know, Jackson, very much cleaving to his horror film roots, pulls it off. It's an amazing opening to an epic film. And it starts out, you know, with this jaunty music. They're hobbit-like creatures, you know, very similar looking. And this is the only time we see the actual actor Andy Serkis playing a character. I believe he plays a hobbit back in the Shire when they return from there. At the end of this film, he plays a hobbit that you see in the background at the Green Dragon Inn, I believe. And so we see him here playing full-on Sméagol. And again, it's fun. The music is jaunty. They're fishing. You know, Diagol falls in. And we see the finding of the ring by Diagol and this genesis of Gollum, which is pretty incredible. First, they start fighting over the ring, like, you know, Sméagol's kind of slapping at Diagol. And then all of a sudden, it gets really intense. And before you know it, we're close in on Sméagol as he's strangling to death Diagol underneath him. Of course, we don't see the hands on the neck. We see the facial expression on Sméagol's face, and this incredible driving, jing, 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 like music cue. And man, it could be right out of a horror movie. It's really, really creepy. You know, what I like about this too is it's said in the book often that be sure, you know, Frodo, that Bilbo took so little hurt from the ring because he began his ownership of it with pity. And of course, here, you know, the ownership of Sméagol of the ring is murder, you know, so quite the opposite. And Andy Serkis is really terrific as an actor. I mean, it makes me think I'd love to see him in just more roles. I know he was in Avengers Age of Ultron. Is that sort of, I think when they went to Africa briefly, he was sort of the arms dealer down there. But he's a terrific actor. I would love to see him in more stuff. Then we see the gradual dissolution of Sméagol into Gollum. And they do this very, very creepily, you know, where you see Sméagol and he's sort of getting paler and losing weight. And then his face really starts to transform. And they don't do it CGI until the end. So, you know, they make him up in various stages of kind of decomposition. And we see him crawling into his final little hole under the Misty Mountains. And it's really well done. And really, again, very gruesome to behold. Then we cut back to Isengard. And we have this brief journey by our main heroes through the newly moved, I think they're called Huorns, the younger Ents, who moved Lock, Stock, and Barrel to Helm's Deep and basically destroyed all the orcs after the Battle of Helm's Deep. And they're all just outside Isengard. And there's this great scene. You know, you have to remember, especially if you're reading the book too, that Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli have been chasing after Merry and Pippin for a long time. And they finally come upon them at the beginning of the third volume of these films, you know, and they're feasting and smoking. You know, they find that storehouse at the sort of outer circle of Isengard, where it has like Longbottom Leaf and all the stuff from the Shire. which is kind of a bit of a tease in the book of like why is Shire stuff there and the scouring of a Shire happens, right? But they don't do that in this. It's a great moment when they all come upon them and they you know, Aragorn is astonished and Gimli's angry. You young rascals. And they're drunk, you know, smoking and just like, welcome to, you know, Treebeard has taken management over Isengard. It's very good. So they do the whole voice of Saruman scene. They all, you know, unfortunately, there's a weird thing here where they all, they gather closely around Orthanc as they do in the book. And, you know, Saruman's up on top, but the top of Orthanc is so high that it's kind of a weird disconnect where, you know, they're having a conversation with Saruman, but he's way up at the top of the tower. So it's weird. And Christopher Lee's great. You know, it's his last moments really in the film here. He has that wonderful voice of his, which, you know, think about. In the book, they're always talking about the voice of Saruman. Yeah, I, in my mind's eye, by the way, I kind of call it Saruman. Saruman is something that, you know, the film decided. Maybe that's a correct pronunciation, but after reading it for years, it's Saruman to me. So, you know, pardon sticklers out there. And, you know, they cinematize it up a little bit, you know, in the film. Basically, Gandalf breaks his staff, and that's it. And here, there's this moment where Saruman throws down a firebomb and Gandalf survives it easily, then breaks his staff. So they pop it a little bit. And then here's where Theoden, you know, it's great that they continue to bring the trait and the theme of mercy into the film, where even after all that Grima has done to betray Theoden, that he yells up to Grima that, you know, you no longer need to be with him. Come down, you know, you'll be taken care of even after all that. They do the death of Saruman and Grima here rather than in the Shire. I'm trying to remember the moment where I think Grima stabs Saruman, and I think Legolas actually shoots him in that moment. So he dies, and then Saruman falls down, and he gets impaled on this wheel and slowly rolls forward and under the water. So it's basically thus passes Saruman the White, rather than doing the scouring of the Shire, which I think is smart. I mean, it's a long enough film as it is. I don't think you can fit the scouring of the Shire in. It's like a full-on 20-minute, 25-minute thing in itself. So it makes sense. You know, purists are howling at it. But again, like most of the choices that Jackson has made in this film, I understand why he made it, and I think it's an intelligent decision. Also, we do get the Palantir that falls, and we see Pippin immediately diving in after it, and then Gandalf, you know, very worried, looking at Pippin in a strange way, and then taking the Palantir. And they do this great thing where they must have had two props. One Palantir, when you see Pippin hold it, is a really big crystal ball that you can imagine holding in your hand. But when Gandalf holds it, it's much smaller. So they do that great, you know, again, they're always keeping the size differential between the hobbits and the humans. It's amazing how consistent it is for most of the three films. So we're back at Edoras now, and there's some feasting and drinking, and there's a drinking game between Gimli and Legolas, which is, of course, completely fabricated for the film, but a lot of good fun. Gimli finally passes out, and Legolas, of course, just barely feels something. So, and then there's a little, you know, little heat between Eowyn and Aragorn, and, you know, Theoden basically goes to Eowyn, you know, you've chosen well. And my two sisters, who were very young when they saw this film, hated Eowyn because they were such fans of Arwen. And their romance that, like, they wanted to kill Eowyn in her tracks for even thinking she could be, you know, with Aragorn. I joked to them that these films should be titled The Aragorn Trilogy, and they laugh. He stays true to Arwen here. You know, it's great. I think it's good that they do this, too. They play it up. In one way, he has abandoned Arwen for good reasons, for altruistic reasons, and that, you know, Eowyn would be a fit queen for him should he ascend the throne. So, you know, some nice tension, love triangle-ish stuff there. So then we rejoin Frodo and Sam. And one thing that Return suffers from a little bit more than the other films is that the filmmakers, unfortunately, and who knows, maybe it needs to happen this way. But in some places, it deadens the film. There's a lot of pronouncements in this film. There's a lot of dead dialogue that's right on the nose and kind of falls dead of like, and thus passes the blank of blank, and thus is the battle of this. And I mean, in a weird way, if you read the three Tolkien novels, Return of the King is the more straight-up mythic novel. Like, when you get near the end, it does kind of truncate, and it does truck in that kind of language a bit more. But it stiltifies the film somewhat. And then they also do what, you know, long epic films tend to do, is they emotionally remind the audience of certain things. So we have some what I call underlining, the dramatic underlining here, as Sméagol is talking to himself. And he kind of has reverted to Smeagol at this point, although his Gollum self has jumped back after the events of the Forbidden Pool. So he's reminding the audience of like what's going to happen. Like, we're going to take him to her, and they're going to go through a tunnel, and then she'll do X, Y, and Z. And I thought to myself, you know, we hear too much about what's going on, and it might have been a good thing that a year would have passed and the audience would have kind of forgotten what was going on, and allow us to have Gollum lead them to Shelob's, you know, lair without the underlining of it. Like, don't, you know, first you're telling us what you're going to do and then you do it. I mean, there's nothing that kills drama more than that. So I just wanted to mention that because I noticed it in this film. And I think the filmmakers obviously were probably a little worried that people would have forgotten exactly where they were because they kind of cut it at a really intense place. So, you know, Gollum's big plan was sort of the cliffhanger. So it's kind of, you know, we're being reminded of that plan, which, again, I thought was a bit of a not necessary. This sets up this little story that they do of like Gollum versus Sam and how Gollum tricks Frodo into sort of dissociating Sam, which is, again, a creation of the film. Because as Gollum is talking out loud, Sam hears the end of it where, you know, then we'll take the ring because they'll be dead. So Sam knows that he's planning something. And again, an interesting creation of Jackson's, you know, but again, we're into a multi-volume epic, and I feel like it as not, Jackson has decided, and his writers have decided to create these continual small arcs of drama to cover the flatness of straight-up exposition, you know, like, there's a lot of parts in Two Towers and Return of the King when you're with Frodo and Sam, even a huge Tolkien fan like me, that are pretty boring. I mean, let's face it, they're kind of trudging along, looking at shit, you know, there's not much going on. So I see that Jackson wants to create continual emotional profluence. And that word I take from writing, I think it's a word John Gardner coined. The word profluence is the feeling of when you're reading something that you need to move forward. You know, it's readability, propulsive readability in a sense. So I feel like he's doing that here and creating these little mini arcs of emotional drama where there weren't any in the book. And I think, you know, they're kind of artificial, and I don't really, you know, the Sam versus Gollum thing, like, even as I'm watching it, I'm like, yeah, this is, you know, it's very manipulative and whatever. But it's possible that without it, you know, we get into epic malaise, you know, epic movie malaise, which can happen, where you're following people at a certain point in their journey, and it's like, oh, they went up a couple more mountains, they went over a valley, hey, look, they took a boat, you know. And rather than that, Jackson and his writers decide, hey, we're going to keep you emotionally in the film by, you know, trying to come up with more conflict. And they do it, and it makes sense. Like, they don't invent something that's not endemic to what's going on in the scene. So, you know, like it or not, you know, it is there. We cut back to Edoras, and there's a really great scene right out of the book of Pippin sneaking over to Gandalf and grabbing the Palantir and looking into it. You know, we, the audience, see the eye arrive, and it's really kind of creepy. But, you know, there's the moment of it's taken away, and Gandalf, you know, saves him, and, you know, it was a near miss. And I think this also was part of the book, is that because of Pippin's rashness, they learn a little bit about the enemy's plan. And Pippin had seen the White Tower, or the White City of Minas Tirith, and so right away everyone knows that that's where the stroke is going to fall next. Because at this point, even in the book, they don't really know what Sauron's going to do next, you know, what his next plan is. Is he going to go right after Minas Tirith? Is he going to march on, you know, the west through Gondor, you know, and avoid Minas Tirith? Like, what's his plan? It makes sense. And so they have this brief council of all the main players about what's going to happen, and basically they're going to split up. Gandalf is going to take Pippin, which he does in the book, and they pretty much set off here. There's a tender moment when Merry and Pippin split. This is the first time that they're going to now split up, and, you know, we see how touching Merry is. Like, you know, Pippin's run out of pipe weeds, and Merry, of course, brings him. He's like, this is the last of the long bottle leaf, gives him a little pipe and a pouch. I mean, he's like, you smoke too much, Pip. So they give them a nice little moment together, which will kind of pay off later when Pip finds Merry in the Pelennor Fields after the big battle. You know, they kind of reunite. So I kind of like it. Now we have a bit of a change in some of this information is in the book, but Jackson weaves it into something different. So we now visit Arwen, who's on her way to the Grey Havens with her people. And she has this vision that was similar earlier. I think in the Two Towers we saw, or maybe even Fellowship, we saw Elrond's vision of her life. And it was basically her alone by a tomb that was Aragorn. And in her vision, there are children. So when she sees this, she flips out and rides all the way back to Rivendell and, you know, confronts Elrond about it. He admits that it's true, but that she, you know, she still will die if she stays. And, you know, so it, I kind of like that, that they do it that way. And, you know, again, making it a dramatic arc to it. And it's now that they reforge Narsil into Anduril, Flame of the West. And in the book, of course, Aragorn takes it out of Rivendell when he leaves at the beginning, at the middle of Fellowship. But here, they reforge it now, and of course, it will get to him somehow, and we will see how very soon. So now we cut to Minas Tirith and the arrival of Gandalf with Pippin, and it's, man, it's beautiful. I think this came from, again, a John Howe or Alan Lee painting. It's wonderful. It's almost like half ziggurat, half medieval city, because it's got these levels that kind of wind upwards. Throughout all of the levels is this sort of white rock that forms the prow of the ship. It's just really brilliant production design. And the camera flies up and around as Gandalf and Pippin are riding up the levels to get to the Hall of Denethor, which is wonderful. They get to right before the Hall of the King, and there's this wonderful comedic moment where Gandalf's like, you know, mention nothing of Aragorn. And try not to speak of Boromir, you know, and don't say anything about that. You know what? It would be best if you said nothing at all, you know. So a nice bit of comedy before we get into the intense Denethor scene to come. And they do it right where, you know, this is the steward. So there's the huge throne, and then the steward is sitting in a, you know, sort of a throne at the steps of the main throne dais, and not the throne itself, which is great. It gives us a visual cue that Denethor is the ruler of Minas Tirith, but he is a steward and not a king. We see him holding the cleaved horn of Boromir in his lap, and Pippin feels so bad about it that, you know, as in the book, offers his service immediately. And I have to say, actor John Noble is just incredible as Denethor. He's so commanding in his sort of vain ambition and refusal to arm and prepare the city. Like, he's looked way too long into the arts of the enemy and the Palantir, kind of like Saruman, but he hasn't turned, you know, his despair hasn't made him join Sauron. He desperately wanted the ring, number one, out of Sauron's keeping, but as this thing that it could be used in matters of last resort. But John Noble is astounding. And I will say this again, the second line casting in this film is so good. They were not afraid to put really powerful actors next to our stars. And sometimes if you have too powerful a character actor, sometimes it could outflank a movie star. You know, the movie stars are movie stars because of the way the camera processes their face, not so much because they're great actors. So sometimes you have to be careful that if you find a really good actor who's got a really commanding presence, you risk upstaging the star, who then is shown by contrast to be kind of what it is, really just kind of a pretty face, right? And John Noble is amazing. Amazing. But of course, you know, Ian McKellen is so many things. He is a movie star. He is one of the greatest actors of his generation, of the stage, and holds his own against Denethor without, you know, having to overposture himself, allows John Noble to, like, have the scene. So we get a bit of exposition now about the stewards coming into power. If you're kind of a lore master of the books, you know, the line of Numenor, the old Numenorean kings came and founded the two kingdoms, the Northern Kingdom, I think it's of Arnor, which is sort of the old watchtower of Amansul, was part of that in the north, and Gondor in the south. And they settled, and of course now years and years passed, that the line of kings have failed, and at one point, the Numenorean kings just either died off without issue, as they say, or, you know, just kind of bailed and just fell into complete decay. And so the stewards now have taken over managing and ruling the city. And Denethor is like, you know, from a decent line of stewards as well. It hasn't been a king on the throne of Gondor for a long time. But they are of what you know, there's definitely racial stuff in this in terms of not black and white so much, but like the race of Numenor versus the race of men. And, you know, Tolkien sort of says that the men are the lesser, you know, the just straight up stock of men like Boromir and Denethor, kind of the lesser race than the Numenorean men who were given, you know, obsessionally long life and were imbued with these other kind of powers of perception and wisdom and you know, intellect and that sort of thing. We're closer to the Maiar, I believe, I think the Maiar are the, if not God, the angels sort of ish. I'm not too clear on the top slots of the Middle Earth pantheon, as it were. But anyway, I think the Numenoreans were closer to that, you know, and it's kind of half elvish in a way. Anyway, so we get a little expo here, which is kind of cool. And shortly after, we get a bit of Gandalf and Pippin just sitting waiting. This is sort of the deep breath before the plunge, as we are told. It's a very quiet moment when they realize that Mordor is now marching on Gondor, and you know, Gandalf has sort of roused the guards and gotten the city a bit ready because Denethor refused to. So there's a bit of, you know, siege mentality now happening. And we get a voiceover as Gandalf is telling Pippin about the Lord of the Nazgul. We get the intro to the Witch King of Angmar, the ruler of the Nazgul, and Minas Morgul is his city, and that, you know, he's the leader of pretty much Sauron's armies, and that now he will be coming into his own fully and leading the pack, or, you know, at least directing the armed force that comes towards Minas Tirith. And then we cut to Minas Morgul, which is this wonderful, like, emerald green city. And now we're cut back to the point of view of Frodo, Sam, and Gollum. And, you know, we're right at the front. These great watchers at the gate, these beautiful carvings are so cool. And Frodo, of course, you know, because of the ring, is being drawn towards them, and they have to grab him off the gate. And this wonderful green column of energy kind of spirals up and shoots out this long spire on top of the citadel and up into the clouds. And all of a sudden, the doors open and the Witch King's armies spew forth, and it's amazing. We see the Witch King on top, sitting atop one of his, you know, dragons and flying atop as the armies march out to battle with Minas Tirith. It's a really spectacular scene. Now, of course, we cut to Osgiliath, Faramir, and the boat attack at night. You know, Faramir basically at this point is still in Osgiliath trying to hold the city. And there's a wonderful night attack sequence where the orcs are coming in with the fog and they're very quiet. And this is the first time we meet Gothmog, who's this sort of puffy-faced orc who's the, you know, the leader of the basically the general on the ground, lieutenant of Mordor, as it were. It's great. It's a great battle. There's this really quiet approach by boats, and they let the orcs kind of unload the boats into the city, and then there's this battle. And of course, they're incredibly outnumbered, but it's a good fight. Lots of good close-in scenes. You know, really great orc makeup. You know, they really, you know, sometimes with movies, when you get, you know, sometimes you can get really great makeup in a small scene with maybe a few people because you kind of have to do it right. And a lot of times when you go big, unfortunately, you the camera catches how cheesy the makeup is for a lot of the extras that play orcs. And in the big scene, somehow it just kind of lessens the impact. But not here, you know, not with these Jackson films that he, you know, when you go big, everything still looks incredibly realistic. And he's always using inset shots. What I mean by that is an inset shot is, you know, you could be looking at a scene, at a battle scene, and then all of a sudden you're close up on an orc face. You know, it's like an inset. Or a close-up, I guess. Maybe inset might be of a hand or a weapon. But he uses close-ups a lot to remind you that, you know, this is not just we the digital having a good time. Like, you know, these are real creatures who bleed and snarl and sweat and are slick and gross-looking. And so, you know, again, to be this far into an epic and to still be having that, I always just really impressed me. There's a great scene when they're fleeing Osgiliath back to Minas Tirith and the Nazgul now arrive on their incredible dragons, and Gandalf rides from the gate, and this wonderful white light emits from the top of his staff and drives them off, you know, and his horse kind of arcs around with the remnants of the Gondorian guard to get them back into Minas Tirith. There's a really, really wonderful scene. And when they come into the main gate, the courtyard, it's a really wonderful scene, very detailed. The main gate has incredible carvings of figures inset into it. It reminded me of some of the cathedrals in Europe that have these incredible, these doors with all these amazing statues or bas-reliefs carved into it. And this looked very similar, looks so real. Right into the gate in that little area, these wonderful statues are also up, these large statues of men on horseback and warriors, and it's just really wonderful. This is our first moment when Faramir kind of bumps into Gandalf and Pippin, and he looks at Pippin in an askance way, and Gandalf's like, this is not the first halfling you've seen. And so we get this sort of info dump, tell me everything, you know, which is great. And then we have this wonderful lighting of the beacons scene, which I love. It's one of my favorite scenes in this whole film. Denethor obviously refuses to call to Rohan. He doesn't want to do anything. So Gandalf is arming the city. Gandalf is the one who's lighting the beacons. And of course, there are armed guards guarding the beacons. And without a direct order from Denethor, no one's lighting them. So Gandalf has Pippin sort of sneak onto the beacon, which is great. I mean, this is not in the book, but I think it's really a nice choice for the film. Pippin winds up, you know, he jumps onto this huge wood, breaks this oil over it, lights it on fire. And then they do this montage of the beacons and how the beacon gets to Rohan. And it's astounding. Basically what happens here, and I don't know if this is, you know, how true this is in ancient times, but they have these beacons on these mountaintops. And as soon as one beacon is lit, you know, leagues and leagues away, someone, you know, there's like, I guess, a beacon detail of soldiers where, like, you know, maybe if you've pissed off your sergeant, like, he puts you on beacon detail, right? So there are these groups of people who just, you know, camp out for shifts on top of this mountain with, you know, means to kindle fire and wood. And so now the music swells and the camera shows us one beacon and then pivots around that beacon to show us a distant mountain, and we see a tiny fire on that mountain kindle. Then we go to that mountain, and we pivot around that fire, and we see another distant fire. And in that way, we leapfrog all through the mountains of Gondor, all the way to Aragorn sitting on one of the outlying patios of Edoras, and he sees far in the distance this last beacon. And he flips out, and he runs in, he's like, you know, Gondor calls for raid, the beacons are lit, you know, and Theoden says Rohan will answer, so we're like, okay, it's on, you know, it's all for the marbles, now Rohan will ride, and it's going to be this monstrous battle. But the beacon sequence is so cool, and it's so stirring and rousing, and so simple, purely visual, you know, without a lot of hee-haw. You don't hear about it off screen. Oh, we lit the beacons. Hopefully Rohan will come. Like, you see it done. Just, I'm so impressed every time I see this scene. So at this point, we get a scene back in the throne room with Denethor, Faramir, and Gandalf. And they kind of change the lines a little bit from the book and give Faramir some lines about the ring in terms of Boromir bringing the ring back. And Denethor, now that Faramir is back and he tells the story of the ring, Denethor is like completely and utterly furious at him that he didn't bring this gift back and that he let it go. So it's like the last straw of this sort of brother rivalry and father's hatred for his son. And we get these lines about, you know, if Boromir had taken the ring, you would not have recognized your son when he returned. So that's kind of neat. And we just see how much Faramir kind of has getting the shaft, as it were, here. Back at Minas Morgul, they're climbing up the stairs of Cirith Ungol, and we're getting, Gollum is now setting Sam up by saying the fat one, you know, he's the enemy, and, you know, Smeagol understands. You know, again, this is more stuff that's created whole cloth for the film, but works very well, that Gollum is trying to gain Frodo's trust by saying, you know, Smeagol knows what it's like to carry the ring because he carried it for years, you know. So, and then saying Sam, you know, the fat hobbit will try to, you know, he'll try to take it from us and he'll ask to borrow it or to carry it and so on and so forth. So there's a nice setup there for what's going to happen. So they do this thing where, you know, Gollum wakes up at night, he takes the Lembas bread and he basically, you know, crumbles a bit of it over Sam and then tosses the rest of it over the cliff. And so in the morning, when it's discovered gone, you know, Sam knows basically that it was Gollum. Sam says the Lembas bread is gone, and Frodo's like, that's the last of our food. And Gollum points out, you know, that there's crumbs all over Sam's body. And then, of course, Sam at that point, because Frodo's in such bad shape, asks if he can carry the ring for a while, and that's sort of the final straw. Frodo rejects Sam and goes off with Gollum. So, you know, they set it up pretty well, all in all, whether you think it's a right thing to do in terms of the story of the book or not. Like, I think they, you know, it's very credible. So Sam now heads back down the stairs, basically heading back wherever he's going to go. And then we cut back to the Gondorian throne room, and Pippin is reciting the Gondorian oath in front of Denethor, which is kind of cute. You know, he was given Faramir's clothes as a boy, so he's wearing sort of livery of the, you know, the House of the Kings. And we hear him send off Faramir to die. And, you know, Faramir is like, you wished I died in Boromir's stead. And Denethor says, yes, I do. Pretty intense, really good, you know, tough scene of a father just basically like, you know, I wish you had died instead of the other son. Pretty hardcore. And because of his disloyalty, he sends him back out to take Osgiliath, which is completely overrun. And he knows it as well. He's basically sending his son out to die, because he just wants him. He feels so betrayed that he let the ring go, that off he goes. So we do this nice little montage of Faramir. First, there's a, you know, they're walking their horses out of the gate, and the women are throwing these sort of herbs and flowers at their feet as they leave. And at the same time, Denethor asks Pippin to sing a song from the Shire, and Pippin starts to sing. And it's I like that they do it this way, that there's a sort of a montage. As you know, we're not ready for yet another battle yet. So the only thing that's a little interesting is that Pippin starts to sing the song and then they cut away. And then when they cut back, it's like the production values have changed. So it sounds like, you know, Pippin's singing in a recording studio, basically. So it's a little weird in that way that it becomes a little too professional sheened. But whatever, the actor playing Pippin, whose name escapes me at the moment, is really good. You know, we watch basically The men under Faramir charge Osgiliath and are basically mowed down to a man by the orcs, who just shoot arrows at them and basically kill them all. You know, when the song ends, and as well, they're cutting back to Denethor eating, you know, and as he's eating, the juice from the tomatoes is staining and running down his cheek as if, you know, he's feasting on the blood of his own men, right? Just great tactile detail that Jackson throws in. Very cool. So from here, we go back to Dunharrow, which is where the Rohirrim have come to sort of muster. And the twist now here is that Elrond arrives. In the book, I think this is where the Numenoreans arrive, the other Numenorean rangers come to join Aragorn and his quest, and they stay with him pretty much throughout the whole thing. But so here, you know, we're getting a bunch of information. So we're getting the fact that the power of the Valar is leaving Arwen, and there's one point we see her where, you know, she even says that the power of the Valar has left me, so she's become mortal now. Obviously very of long life, but, you know, the elvish magical power that keeps them alive for long periods of time has now left her. What we're given, what they do here is they tie in Arwen's fate to the ring and to the success of all this, because basically what they're saying is, I think what's kind of happening here is Sauron's evil has grown to such a degree that it's draining the life out of Arwen and anyone connected to the elves and the rings. I think they're, you know, the elves have three rings. I'm not exactly sure, but what they do is they basically, Elrond's basically like, Sauron must be overthrown or Arwen will die, you know? So we don't know in exactly what time, but I respect that they're trying to unify everything, that Arwen's just not sitting around waiting for Aragorn to win or lose and then be married, that her existence is at stake, that if Sauron waxes, finds the ring or grows stronger, that she'll, you know, she will basically die even faster. So I think that's clever. Again, not in the book, but I think it serves the story pretty well. Of course, you know, now Elrond visits the camp and he has Anduril with him, Flame of the West. This is the big moment when Elrond's kind of recognizing that it's time for Aragorn to shed the mantle of the Ranger from the North and become the King of Gondor and take up his inheritance. So it's kind of a big moment. They make a moment out of it, which is kind of cool. Soon after, we have Eowyn and Aragorn, and there's this moment where she pretty much declares herself for him. And he straight up turns her down. And so that's kind of cleared, you know, that like he's like, you know what, I can't, I'm not for you, and I'm out. And then they have to tread the paths of the dead, which is they also do in the book. And Gimli and Legolas have to come with them. And there's a great line after they leave, you know, everyone in the camp wakes up, it's the middle of the night, and the three of them ride into this, you know, crack in this gap in the mountains. And we see them ride away. And all of the Rohirrim are all pretty upset and pretty, you know, weirded out about it, because Aragorn has kind of become a de facto leader of all of them. And they ask Théoden, you know, rather than have this bullshit, you know, before the battle speech, he goes, you know, quote, "We cannot defeat the armies of Mordor, but we will meet them in battle nonetheless." You know, and it's a great, like, kick-ass line of like, "No, we can't win, but, you know, we will fight to the last." I think in that one line, it's better than having, you know, Théoden do this whole speech about how men should be true and all this crap, you know. So I think it really works well. Just, you know, Théoden gets hardcore near the end, you know, and his death is, you know, his last few hours are really intense, and then his death is pretty cool. So, yeah. So then we do this, the dead kingdom in the mountain. And some pretty cool ghost effects. Again, you know, Jackson back in horror movie mode. You know, he's full on ghosts, right? And it's all kind of in these sheens of emerald green and other greens. And we see the dead, you know, surround our heroes. And they're definitely CGI, but they're supposed to be ghosts, so you kind of buy it. The King of the Dead is wonderfully gory. You know, his face is kind of half rotted away, and he's got this mouth, and we're not sure if we can see his eyes or not. Pretty creepy. And then at some point when they're in the center of all this, we see the, you know, the kingdom itself, the structures of the kingdom emerge as these legions and legions of dead all surrounding our heroes. And then in the theatrical version, it ends on a cliffhanger. The Ghost King attacks Aragorn after he says, "Fight for us, fight for us, fight for us," and no one answers. And then the Ghost King laughs. And then the Ghost King takes his sword out and is about to hew down Aragorn, and Anduril blocks the blade, surprising the king. And I think then we cut away to other things. And I don't think we see Aragorn and the rest of this crew again until they jump off the ships back then. But in the extended version, we get a little bit more. There also is this quake, and I don't remember the quake in the theatrical either. There's an earthquake, and there's like millions of skulls. They drown. Our three heroes kind of drown in a sea of skulls. And they finally, you know, they are able to escape the citadel on the other side of the mountain. And the three of them see the Black Corsair fleet, which is, if you've read the book, And you get a little bit of this in the film, but it's much more in the book that not only the armies of coming out of Mordor are going to attack Minas Tirith, but this Black Corsair fleet is coming up from the south. It's going to be in a pincer movement on two fronts. It's pretty much going to take the city. So we have Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas as the ships are passing by, and they have this parley where everyone on the boats is kind of laughing at them. And at that moment, the king, you know, comes out to Aragorn and says, "We will fight." They swarm out, and they're visible, and they swarm across the water and basically engulf these ships, which I think takes away from the wonderful Han Solo moment when they arrive later in the battle, when you don't really know who it is, and, you know, there's knife work here, boys, and, you know, you see the ships arrive, and you think that, you know, more orcs are coming, and then Aragorn jumps out with his sword, and it's great, but here, like, you know it's coming, you know, so it's a little too much info, and I think he was smart and theatrical to cut it. In the book, they use the dead army to destroy the Black Corsair fleet. And then he considers their oaths fulfilled after this battle. And then it's him and the Numenorean kings who board the ships and sail and sort of do a little Han Solo moment in the book. So we don't really see the Army of the Dead in action in the book. We kind of hear about it later. I think it's told by Gimli in like Houses of Healing or something. They tell the story later on about what happened, which, you know, Tolkien does from time to time. He'll move forward with something and then he'll kind of tell a backstory a little bit afterwards. So they do that in the book. And I like that they keep the Ghost Army here until the very end. I think it's a nice moment of like, you know, the cavalry coming at the end. And we see this Ghost Army kind of flow in. I'll get to that later, but we get to the main battle. So now we start with the full Battle of the Pelennor Fields, Siege of Gondor, in earnest. And it is a spectacular battle, probably the most incredible battle in the entire last two movies, as the first movie doesn't really have a lot of battle scenes or any battle scenes, frankly, in it. It's an astonishing battle sequence. And I think why the Battle of the Pelennor Fields sequence works is the same reason that the Helm's Deep battle is so amazing, is that there's a thought given to novelty of action, all different types of battles. There are small mini narratives within the battle that you're following, and things are just continually moving and changing. Plus, he's cutting away at certain moments to Frodo, Sam, and Gollum. So you've got a lot of movement in terms of narrative, and you've got a lot of sort of thorny little subplots going on inside the battle. And it's just a delight to watch from beginning to end, frankly. We start off with this massive scope, these big widescreen shots of the just legions and 10,000 strong orcs, just breathtaking to look. And he does what he has done before, where, you know, we get these big widescreen shots and then we're close on in a very tactile bunch of close-ups, and we see them cranking down these catapults, and we're close up on these metal gears, and we see, you know, the gears turning and the metal clanking into the teeth, and they turn it a little more and clank it into the teeth. And when, again, we see how the catapults work. It's not just like, you know, army, you know, movie catapults. We're actually seeing how they function. And it's being done close up, you know, with a lot of good Foley work and a lot of good close up stuff. And so, really great. Right before they get close to the city, Faramir is dragged. He's the only one to survive that initial attack. And he's being dragged by his horse through the city gates. And at that moment, the first wave of catapults are released. And it's the heads of all the dead Gondorian warriors who've been fighting in Osgiliath forever, and very grisly, and very much the same as the book. I mean, Tolkien did it in the book, and they kept it. You know, it's just a really great moment. You see these heads coming over the walls, kind of psych warfare, Middle Age style, you know? And they start out with the first wave of battle where, you know, the catapults are throwing stones into the city instead of fireballs. And I think it's very, you know, kind of a subtle thing to mention, but I like, as you're watching it, the stones are doing incredible amounts of damage. They're hurling these huge stones at the city of Minas Tirith, but where the stones impact the walls, they're pretty much crushing the stone buildings inside the city and taking them down. So, you know, you could just see the director and the special effects people sitting around a table, you know, mapping out how they're going to do a battle scene, saying, all right, so, you know, they got these explosive things and they hurl them and they explode, you know, thinking in terms of 20th century and, you know, epic filmmaking, and they don't explode. That, you know, there's some fireballs that happen later at night. Again, at night when it's cool to look at, when it's in the dark. But right now they're just hurling these huge stones at the city and we're seeing them crumble. And there's just something about the restraint of that I find awesome. We rejoin Denethor on the parapet as he, you know, he basically walks out and looks over the wall and sees this ridiculous army and screams, "Abandon your post, you know, run for your lives." And basically Gandalf knocks him out on the head. steps in his place and, you know, prepare for battle. So Gandalf pretty much is taking command of the city's defense. And we start out seeing these massive trebuchets from the city of Minas Tirith are starting to be unloaded, and we just see them in action. Trebuchets are really cool weapon. There's a massive counterweight at the bottom of it, and it can hurl things for just, you know, incredible distances rather than just a straight up catapult. It's got kind of an extra hook to it. So we see that the Minas Tirith is loaded with them, and they start hurling these pieces of basically broken masonry that have come from the city itself back out towards the orc army, taking down some of their siege towers and so on and so forth. And really cool. As this starts, We follow one stone as it comes out of the trebuchet. The camera kind of comes in behind it, and it's flying right along with it. And we see it, you know, fly all the way down the battlements and crush like a, you know, maybe a squadron of orcs on the ground. Really neat. The Nazgul now attack. So, and we also see why the Nazgul are as horrible as they are. And it's twofold. Number one, they're constantly screaming, and the screams are like so earth-shattering, and it's so hard to bear by the human ear. So we see soldiers kind of trying to cover their ears. And then secondly, very practically, they just hurl men from the walls. They sweep in and grab men and trebuchets and catapults and just like pick them up briefly and then drop them, and they fall, you know, leagues down and die. So it's pretty cool. And then there's a lot of camera work behind the Nazgul as they're flying around and giving us this kind of, you know, three-dimensionality of it. And it's really well done. And some of the siege towers now make it to the walls. So again, you know, we've got our siege towers as Helm's Deep. These are protected siege towers, so they're kind of closed in already the same height as the walls, just being wheeled forward. So not as, you know, a little more robust, shall we say. The battle is now raging up on the walls, and Gandalf is in full swing here with his staff and his sword going at it. And Pippin saves him from an orc, because Pippin has come briefly just kind of to see the battle, and he saves Gandalf from getting killed. Basically, we start to see the orcs at the gate, they're having trouble getting into the gate, and they're getting decimated by the archers from Gondor. We see Gothmog talk about Grond will breach the gate. And if you remember in the book, Grond is this huge metal ram that they use. And they totally do Grond in the movie, like in the most amazing way you've ever seen. It's a massive metal wolf's head ram. And at the very tip of it, so it's like a steel ram. It's not wood. It's like, you know, half a football field long. And in the front of it, its jaws are kind of open, and we see the teeth, and they build a fire in there. It's like, it's the coolest thing, you know, you've ever seen. They kindle this fire in its mouth, and it's just unbelievable. So from a brief glimpse of Grond, we now cut back to Frodo, Gollum, and Sam. And now we have this, you know, Frodo has his encounter with Shelob, and it's very scary, very horror movie yet again. Lots of bones and skeletons, and Frodo in the web, and Gollum completely abandons him, and we see these things, this dead bird, half-eaten animals all around, really, really creepy. And then we intercut it with Sam down on the steps of Cirith Ungol a little farther below, finding the Lembas bread on the stairs, and then realizing that, you know, running back up, realizing that, you know, it was actually Gollum and it wasn't him, and he's going to prove it to Frodo, and so, you know, on his way back up, hurriedly trying to save his friend. So there's some good moments. Frodo breaks out the Light of Elendil, which was given to him by Galadriel, you know, when all of the lights go out. So that happens. He breaks out Sting. And so he cuts himself out at one point. And Shelob is really amazing in the screen. It's like half CGI. I'm sure there was some regular special effects works done, because it is creepy, man. Multiple eyes and jaws dripping like viscous fluid. Really visceral. Really frightening, actually. You know, again, for a movie like this, to have a really, really visceral and creepy spider does not look fake at all. And again, horror movie roots yet again. So he cuts his way out, and he gets out, and Gollum winds up attacking him at some point. But Gollum tries to go for the ring, and Frodo, you know, anyone touching the ring now, Frodo is now filled with like supernatural strength. And Gollum realizes that he's not going to beat him physically, and so he talks his way out of it yet again. You know, saying the ring made us do it, the ring made us do it. And of course, he's always playing to Frodo's, you know, side of like understanding, like of knowing about the ring, which is great. But then, finally, this is like the final break now that Frodo tells him that he's going to destroy it. And Gollum goes berserk, but he winds up falling off the cliff, and we don't see what happens to him. Obviously, he's not out of the action just yet. Then we cut away, and we cut to the employment of Grond back to the gate. And it is unbelievable. we see these massive trolls swinging it way back. Sees a couple of times. And a couple of great things they do here. First of all, when it's swinging, we cut to a side-on shot of Grand moving within. Like, it's swinging in this sort of frame that it's been brought up in. So it's like it's inside this sort of frame where it can swing back and forth loosely. And as part of the surrounding frame, there's these gangways next to it. So what Jackson does is give us a sense of how big Grand really is. He shows a side-on shot of Grand as it's being swung. So we see it moving, first of all. Then we see the orcs, you know, next to it on the platform as soon as it breaches the gate, ready to jump in. So we get a sense of how big the bloody thing is because of the orcs in the same frame. And I just always thought that was very clever. And when it finally breaks the gate, the camera is pointed at the gate, and all we see is a splintering gate and the metal head of Grand pushing through with his jaws and the fire burning inside its mouth. You're just like, what the F? You know, it's a spectacular scene. Again, just novel thing after novel thing over and over again in this battle. You know, it's nonstop. So, of course, you know, Gandalf is rallying the troops, but the first through the door are these massive trolls, which are, they're completely armored, huge, and there's this initial battle that's just sweeping everyone aside, and the battle is not going well for them at this moment. And so we cut away when things are looking pretty bleak back to Frodo and Sam, and now there's this really great scene that where Frodo gets stabbed. So we see Frodo walking, and then the camera is very low angle pointing up at him. And we see Shelob up and around, like climbing over the rocks over his head. And he's unaware that she's there. And she's completely silent. It's really creepy how it's shot. Really wonderful. And he's pretty much full on stabbed, really right in the gut. And we see Shelob roll him up and cocoon him. And then Sam basically bursts on the scene to the rescue. He's got the Light of Elendil and Sting in the other hand. So they have this wonderful battle, which gets very intense. And Sam is, you know, basically barely being missed, stung with Shelob's tail. He's kind of poking out her eyes as it goes. And he's very close to her at some point in her head claws. Really, really kind of gross. And finally gets her in the belly with the light in his hand, you know. He wins, and she sort of slinks back in her little hole. Really, really intense little scene. And of course, like the book, Sam thinking Frodo is dead, and you know, us the viewer, we're looking at him straight on. His eyes are open. His face is very white and pale. We figure he's dead, takes the ring, continues on, and then overhears the orcs talking about this fella dead, you know, realizes that he's still alive. Again, the orcs are in incredible makeup. They really look great. And so he follows you know, just behind them towards the Tower of Cirith Ungol, where he will make his rescue attempt.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Yes, my friends, but we do use money in the 21st century. Let's think about $1 for a minute. If you contribute $1 per episode via Patreon, $4 a month, $52 a year. If you like what I'm doing at Sci-Fi on Screen, you're really enjoying the show, I invite you to become a Patreon subscriber. My first goal I'm setting is $50 per show. I'm at about $26 and change right now. At $50 a show, I would really like to improve the quality of the sound for you guys, and I could buy a really good microphone and a booth so you guys can get the best sound I could possibly provide. So $1 a show a week. Sign up at patreon.com/scifionscreen. There's a button on my website, takes you right to the site. Signing up is a snap, and you're on your way. Until the 23rd century does arrive and we no longer need money, I would love your support via Patreon. Thanks for listening.
Blah, blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah, blah. No, blah, blah, blah!
So the Minas Tirith battle is going badly. The orcs have now taken the first level, and we see the butchery of the citizens and of the soldiers by the orcs. And the music cue is also kind of telling us that, you know, things are dire right now. Like, it's not looking good for our side. And there's this moment, it's probably my favorite scene now in the extended version of this film. It was not in the theatrical version. So when I watched the extended and I saw it, it just kind of blew my mind. So the Gondorians now have taken refuge in the second level, and they're behind a bunch of doors. And basically, the trolls are kind of at the gates. And it's kind of curtains at this point. And it's at this point when the Witch King of Angmar comes out on its creature. It alights right down next to Gandalf and basically says, you know, this is your hour, old man. And there's this moment where the camera is looking up at the Witch King, and it pulls its sword out and sticks it up in the air, and these flames race along from the hilt all the way up to the tip. And because it's done in perspective, as if we're looking straight up at it, like, it's the most epic, evil, cool shot you've ever seen. So if you've never seen this shot, I would just go to YouTube and say Witch King of Angmar, you know, battle scene, or Witch King of Angmar sword or something, and you'll see it. And it's just an unbelievable scene. And he breaks Gandalf's staff. So in this moment in the film, we're given to believe that the Witch King, you know, is more powerful than Gandalf and could possibly destroy him. In the book, the Witch King comes in and they kind of have a standoff. The Witch King, you know, both talking trash at each other. And it's that moment when the Rohirrim ride, and so the Witch King bails. So in the movie, they push it a little bit by having Gandalf's staff be broken by this Witch King. So, you know, we're curious to hear from some fans about what they think about that. You know, like, our beloved Gandalf has been somehow one-upped, and he's basically rarely lost a battle. You know, he died fighting the Balrog, but killed it. And here, it seems as if the Witch King is a stronger opponent. And I was always curious about that, even in the novel. And I think because Tolkien's setting up the death of the Witch King by Eowyn and the prophecy that no man can kill me, that he doesn't push it in the book too much. So you're guessing in the book whether or not he can take Gandalf. And in the movie, they kind of push it a little bit. So very interesting. Now the wonderful ride of the Rohirrim, which is just magnificent, this massed wall of horses, which I think, you know, mostly real. He did a lot of horse stunts in these final two films, and he really used full-on horses, you know, and augmented with CGI, and it really shows. They have these wonderful spears. We get a wonderful long view of the battlefield and of the Rohirrim coming. And there's a moment when Theoden rides along laterally along the front rank of his riders, and the spears are out, and he's holding up his sword, and it's hitting all the spears and making this wonderful ka-ka-ka-ka-ka sound as he goes. And at the same time, we watch the orcs now set themselves, because Gothmog realizes that they're being flanked, so he's taken a bunch of his soldiers. They've the pikemen, and they set themselves kneeling down and setting their pikes to impale the horses and their riders as they come. So real military tactics. So Jackson, you know, really knows his stuff here. Gives us a very clear version of what's about to happen here and who's preparing for what. And there's the wonderful ride. You know, we see Merry and Eowyn as well riding together. And just at the moment of impact, they cut out the sound briefly. And the music cues to just give us that smack of horse on flesh and armor. Really a wonderful start to this, you know, cavalry charge, which is, by all accounts, if you've ever read, a pretty terrifying thing if you're on the other end of it. So from here, we're getting now, we cut to the Faramir near death scene with Denethor in the halls of his forebears. Basically, Denethor is repenting and realizing what he has done to Faramir and pretty much hates himself. He's about to burn himself and Faramir alive, which is very much right out of the book. John Noble is just so creepy here. There's a moment right before he catches fire. Faramir wakes up. When is that moment when he realizes kind of everything that's going on? But he lights on fire, and he runs out of the pyre room and across the quad, as it were, and jumps off the prow of the very top of Minas Tirith and falls like a fireball down below. And we get kind of a line straight out of the book. It's a little thud of a line. It's like, thus passes Denethor, son of Ecthelion, lord of Gondor, whatever. You know, it's like, okay, Gandalf, you know, we get it. And now more novelty, right? We've had the Ride of the Rohirrim as another thing, and now the giant elephants, which is just really crazy. They're a little too big for me. I just found that they were a little too big. You know, like, sometimes I found Orthanc a little too tall. The elephants are just a little too huge. They're like too oversized. Basically, you know, we're getting kind of a dinosaur level or Godzilla level battle scene as well. And we're not bored by more of the same fighting. You know, we had the cavalry charge. Now we're getting the charge, the counterattack by these incredible elephant warriors. And the horns of the elephants are spiked, so when it, you know, when they sweep their horns aside on the ground, they basically take out, you know, just swaths of the Rohirrim and other men, and it's really spectacular. And atop them are these men with bows, so they're kind of like giant tanks, frankly. They're all these the Southron men on top. Their garb and their makeup very much reminded me of Wes from the character who's second to Humongous in The Road Warrior. Very similar. And, you know, Jackson's from New Zealand, and who knows, you know. But to me, it was very much Road Warrior-ish production design in terms of the costumes and the face paint. Really interesting. We see how one of these things could be taken down you know, they're basically guided by these main riders who sit behind the ears. And so Eomer takes one out with a spear. When that guy falls, the reins go with him, and he pulls one, sort of the elephant under him, is pulled to the right irreversibly and crashes into like another one of itself, and they both go down. And pretty much once they're down, they're kind of done. So it was really cool of like how you could possibly take these things down without being magical in any way. And so we see it happen. We also see Eowyn hobbling several, where she'll ride underneath it and use her swords to slash at their feet. There's a scale problem here because they are so big that I don't think she could reach both legs as she rode under it. But when they shoot it, they do it so she can reach both legs. And I thought that was just, they wanted her to do that, so she did it. But it's a little bit of a scale problem for sure. Now, there's a scene here of Merry killing a lot of orcs, and I find that kind of ridiculous. Anytime any of the hobbits wind up killing any of the orcs, I find it kind of preposterous, unless it's a real specialized kind of thing and they're in a position where they can easily dispatch them. But they're good guys, they have swords, you know, they're killing bad guys. It's kind of part of the thing. But not a lot of that, I think, was in the book, and it's kind of goofy when you see it. Then there's this wonderful scene between Gandalf and Pippin. Again, they're sitting waiting for the doors to be smashed down. They haven't been yet. The Witch King is gone. Gandalf's staff has been smashed, and you know Pippin's afraid to die. And Gandalf sort of describes what the books call the Blessed Lands, which is where all the elves go, and the hobbits and Gandalf, when they leave the Grey Havens, and you sail over the sea to what's called the Blessed Lands. It's basically kind of like, you know, going to heaven without dying, seemingly to me. But it's a wonderful scene where Gandalf's like, oh, death is not the end. It's simply another stage of the journey. And there's a green land with a swift sunrise. And you hear this and you hear that. And Pippin's sort of like, you know, that's not too bad. And it's a nice pause in what is a very enjoyably watchable spectacle of a battle. It's not boring, and it doesn't even really need so much of a break. It has its own wonderful rhythm and novelty to it, and yet it's good that it's here, that we rest a little bit with these two characters, and we kind of talk about what it might be like to face death in this battle, which I think is great. Now it's the end of the Witch King's last battle. They're doing pretty well against the elephants, and the Witch King, I guess, realizes that Theoden is sort of the rallying point. So he basically, you know, he flies down with his mount, and his mount picks up Theoden on his horse and just throws it, and it tumbles over like 3 or 4 times, and Theoden lands under his horse, pretty much done. And then we get this moment where, you know, the beast is going to feast on Theoden's flesh, and Eowyn gets in the way and chops the neck off. And when the beast flops down, we see then the Witch King slowly rise up with this massive mace, which is the coolest looking mace I think I've ever seen. And we can hear the metal of the chain clinking as he raises it up. And it's a great battle. Basically, Eowyn ducking and him, you know, wailing this incredible mace over his head. And the camera's kept very low, so we're always aware of how menacing and large and incredibly impressive the Witch King is. Eowyn finally, her shield is shattered and her arm is basically taken out, and she's pretty much done. And then we cut away to the black ships. You know, Jackson's kind of lining things up for these Hour of Doom, right? Gandalf is kind of huddled behind a wall. Theoden just been taken down, and now, you know, Eowyn is possibly going to die as well. And so we're sort of like, this is the all is lost moment. And now we cut to the moment of Aragorn coming off the ships with Gimli and Legolas and the orcs laughing. And of course, being then followed by the green, gooey dead who's come and just start, you know, killing everybody. And in that moment, Eowyn does get up with her sword. And, you know, I will kill you if you touch him, and no man can kill me. And then this is Merry's moment where Merry stabs it in the back of the knee. It goes down, and Eowyn stabs into the... I mean, the helmet of the Witch King is so great in that it's just a black helmet. There's no face. It's empty inside, which I think was such an amazing choice. And there's this effect now, as if the helmet was somehow being imploded from the inside in fast speed. It's the most astonishing thing you'll see. It's like, you know, it's not what you would ever expect. You know, when a supernatural entity is killed in a movie like this, there's certain expectations you have about what it's going to look like. The head denting in and twisting and turning the way it is. Again, it's Google, you know, Death of the Witch King, and it's an astonishing scene, and very uncanny, and it takes you completely by surprise, and I think it's fabulous. You know, and we're finishing up here, but it's Marvel upon Marvel. Now we have Legolas versus the elephant, right? Which is fun for sure. I'm not so much into these. This is more like Indiana Jones kind of stuff, where Legolas jumps up and he does all these things and kills all these people and kills the elephant and then winds up sliding up the trunk, landing gently as the elephant crashes down behind him. And of course, Gimli says, "It still only counts as one," you know. Okay, it's fine. It is what it is. And now the battle is over. The dead are flowing up into the city like a green tide. There's a wonderful scene between Theoden and Eowyn as he, you know, "I know your face," and she's with him at his moment of death, and he goes to the halls of his fathers. Very tender scene. It's a nice arc for Theoden as well, because we start in with him kind of getting the sense that he feels that he is the lesser of a long and austere line of kings. And now that he says, you know, "I will feel no shame as I stride into the hall of my fathers." And it's beautiful. There's this great tension moment where the dead appeal to Aragorn now, like, "Hey, we've fulfilled part of our bargain. You must release us." And Gimli's like, "Bad idea. These fellows are pretty good in the fight, you know." And of course, Aragorn is, you know, always the good king who makes the right decision and releases them from their oath. And they blow away as if, you know, from a stiff breeze. Pretty amazing scene. Pippin then on the battlefield finds Merry's cloak. We see Eomer completely lose his shit when he sees Eowyn, whom, you know, the last person he would expect to see on a battlefield, which is a very gripping moment. And there's a very solemn undertone to the end of the battle. You know, like so often in films such as this, or epic movies, the ends of battles when the good guys win, it's usually a triumph of some kind of triumphant feel, but this does not feel triumphant. It feels tragic, which I think is correct. And truthfully, they've only really survived the opening battle of the war, you know, and there is a lot of death there. There's Theoden, there's possibly Eowyn in this moment. You know, we don't know what happened to Merry, and we may have lost a lot here. And this sense of doom kind of pervades everyone, like they came through something really incredible, but there's no triumphalism here, which, again, just I'm so proud of the movie for that. And Aragorn kind of gets busy right away. You know, there's this whole thing about the hands of the king being healing hands. He's seen bringing Eowyn back pretty much from near death as well. And we see Faramir and her in some kind of cutaway shots, and they kind of connect in the House of the Healing, which we don't see in the theatrical cut, but was very much in the book. Pippin finally finds Merry on the battlefield alive. It's a very sweet scene. We cut back to the Tower of Cirith Ungol, or Cirith Ungol, however you want to pronounce it. We have Sam sort of approaching, despairing that he's going to get up to, you know, get Frodo. And of course, we have this scuffle between two orcs fighting over the ring, which then expands into one orc faction fighting another. And the hand-to-hand orc fighting is great. Again, very gritty, lots of blood, lots of, you know, orcs being gutted, which is awesome. By the time Sam gets there, they're pretty much all dead. On his way up to find Frodo, he finds a few orcs and he kills three of them, which I just find bunk. You know, I find that that hobbits killing orcs, regardless of what they've been through, is kind of bunk. But, you know, I think in the book, when he gets there, it's deserted. And maybe there's one orc that he barely fights off and kills. But here, like, it's, you know, "That's for my old gaffer." He's, you know, Sam the warrior. In a brief scene, we see one get away with the mithril shirt, which is going to come into play a little bit later. There's a bit of, I guess at this point I'm calling ringery between Sam and Frodo, you know, the back and forth. "Frodo, it's the ring. I know, Sam. It's killing you. I know it is." They get to the sort of the edge of the mountains, and we see finally Mount Doom after all this time. They are very close. Looks a bit CGI, but, you know, I'm nitpicking. And we do see the encampment of all the orc armies between them and the mountain, seemingly impassable, right? So we then cut to, in the book, the chapter's called The Last Debate, where all the principals of the major factions of the West are kind of debating what to do next. In the novels, Gandalf comes up with all the planning. He's like, "Hey, we'll draw Sauron's armies out to give Frodo time," and Aragorn's just kind of there. And they give those lines to Aragorn here, and they kind of make Gandalf a little more fallible, and he's like, you know, "There isn't much hope. There was only a fool's hope." And Aragorn, it's like, "No, we can do one more thing for Frodo," which is kind of cool because, you know, the character of Gandalf really is the counselor. And the Aragorn character is kind of the leader. And in that leader, you know, in that protagonist's position, you know, you are coming up with the big ideas. You're kind of coming up with the plans. It's kind of your thing, you know. So they easily agree. Eomer is there, who is now the leader of the Rohirrim. Gimli has the great line, quote, certainty of death, small chance of success, what are we waiting for? Which I think is great. There's a brief moment now, I think was only in the extended, where Aragorn finally reveals himself to Sauron via the Palantir of Denethor's. Or it's the one Gandalf had, I don't quite remember. I know in the book, Denethor took his Palantir on his pyre, and Gandalf had said, you know, well, the book had said at some point it was long until anyone was able to ever turn that Palantir away from the flames and the agony of Denethor to use in another fashion. So it's possible that Aragorn is using the Palantir that Saruman had. But anyway, shows Sauron the sword and that he's alive and ready to fight. Sauron, ever wily, shows him Arwen, who's dying, and it really hits him right in the gut. And he drops the Palantir and he, you know, falls back. And so, you know, pretty tough stuff. Sauron went right to his vulnerability. Now we're kind of moving towards our big climax. Frodo and Sam, we cut back. Like the book, they're briefly drafted into the orc army that's moving towards the gate because they're wearing their armor and they have helmets. And, you know, they start a bit of a fight and they escape during the scuffle and off they go to Orodruin, as they call Mount Doom. Now we continue to cut back and forth between the forces getting to the Black Gate and Frodo and Sam and, of course, you know, Gollum slinking around behind, closing in. And then there's a great sequence, another great bit that they had to cut for the theatrical version. In the book, this character called the Mouth of Sauron comes out, and he's sort of the lieutenant who is once... The book hints that it's a ruined Dunedain. That it's like one of the Dunedain men of the West, I think, who's been kind of ruined and twisted, I think. It's not one of the, you know, it's not a spectral minion of Sauron. So he's not a, you know, he's not like a Nazgul. It's a real old man or old human who's been twisted up and still alive. And the gates start to open up. Again, I love the gates opening. It's so cool. And they stop just enough for the Mouth of Sauron to kind of come out. It's an amazing costume design. There's metal... The metal helmet comes all the way down to the nose, so there's no eyes. You know, I guess Jackson and his production team took moniker in the book, The Mouth of Sauron, literally, and the camera closes up on this hideous, hideous mouth with these long yellow teeth, and the voice is very processed. It's, I am the voice of, you know, very low, kind of like a death metal growl. It's really, really gruesome and creepy. I really like it. And again, as Sauron is sort of hitting Aragorn below the belt with Arwen, the Mouth of Sauron pulls up the mithril coat. Merry and Pippin both react, and of course Gandalf is like, be silent, you know, and we see the Mouth of Sauron like, oh, he was known to you and dear from what I can tell, you know. And I think in the book they allow him to retreat back into Mordor unscathed, but here Aragorn beheads him basically. And now the gate's fully open and we see the ocean of orcs and trolls coming out with the Eye of Sauron sort of perched above them on the top of Barad-dûr. It's a really beautiful scene. Again, just super epic and coming from a John Howe or Alan Lee painting. I can never tell them apart. And this is it. I mean, we're here. These three movies all together is like a 12-hour viewage. And we've got to have a bit of a, you know, beginning of the battle speech. They do a pretty good job. I mean, the idea of the speech is... Aragorn saying, you know, I see you're all scared, and a day may come when XYZ, but it is not this day. A day may come when this happens, but it is not this day. Blah, 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 blah. So it's pretty good. It's not long. For these kind of speeches, you know, they can be really cheesy, and they can be really ponderous at the end of such a long movie and a long series. But Viggo nails it. Like, he does a good job. You know, Viggo Mortensen as an actor is really good, and he had to be convinced to play Aragorn, because if you see his film history, like, he's not one of those actors. Like, he's not a Charlton Heston. He's not Russell Crowe. Like, he's not a big, swaggering actor who's going to do those kind of pronouncement-like heavy roles. Like, he's kind of a character actor. So it was nice that they cast him against type, and the speech is kind of against type as well. So there's something about that was unified that I liked. So it was great. Now we cut back to Orodruin, and we're on the slopes of the mountain. The lava comets are coming out, which is really beautiful. And we have this wonderful emotional moment where Frodo can't actually walk anymore, and Sam carries him. And then we cut back to the battle, and Gimli remarks to Legolas, never thought I'd be standing in my last fight side by side with an elf. And of course, Legolas says, how about side by side with a friend? Aw, we love it. And so, you know, when Sam picks up Frodo and now we're back and he's walking towards Mount Doom, Remarkably, after a zillion hours of epic filmmaking, there's enough juice still to have me gripping my seat like, man, we're almost there, you know? And again, it's a testament to what an epic is supposed to do. It's supposed to exist in this massive scope, and at the same time, it's supposed to continually be granular and have small leapfrogging stories that you're, you know, that you're being brought along by lots of integral small stories. And before you know it, you know, miles down the road, whether it's War and Peace or, you know, Lord of the Rings, you're now nearing this epic climax. And the whole weight of everything is supposed to come to bear on you. And I think in this movie, boy, does it, you know, really, really awe-inspiring at this moment. And so, of course, back in the battle now, you know, Aragorn, his whole character has been, when his moment comes, will he have the strength to do what needs to be done and fight the battle that has to be fought? Now, will he have the strength? And he's afraid of his blood, he's afraid of his own weakness. And of course, he smiles and turns, and he's the first one to sort of run towards the orcs. So he, in a sense, has passed his test. Passed the test of the power of his sires before him. It's kind of, in a weird way, him going into the battle is the end of his arc because he's done now. Now the rest of it's kind of up to Frodo. And as he runs towards the orcs, it's very quiet. And, you know, all of the men of the West, you know, and as they, you know, all scream and raise their swords, you know, they're all very slowly it becomes, you know, a loud thing. But it starts off very quiet and very slow motion like. So you're finally, you know, slowly like rolling in to this last battle. So now we get the return of Gollum when they still have a good chunk of ground to cover, and we can see that on the screen. And Sam and Gollum basically are battling as Frodo finally finds his, you know, his strength and staggers all the way up and into the cracks of doom. Just incredible to, you know, amazing to watch. And we're cutting back at the same time, seeing the Nazgul now and the Sea of Orcs, and, you know, our heroes near the Black Gate are really losing big time. And the Eagles are involved from, you know, the Lord of the Eagles from The Hobbit. They're there, and again, more novelty in the midst of the battle. And we see the Eagles taking some of the Nazgul down. And now, I have to talk about this penultimate scene in a couple of ways. Number one, I got to start with the book. And you have to understand, to me, I don't think most people recognize that at the end of this hero's journey, Frodo fails. Like, he decides that he's not going to complete the quest. I mean, think about that, right? I mean, it's like Luke down the trench and decides that he's not going to shoot his, that he's not going to let go of his torpedoes, and somehow Vader shoots at him, misses, and Vader's torpedoes go in, right? I mean, it's kind of what happens here. I cannot overstate how powerful the metaphor is that Tolkien understands. He understands what he's doing. Like, he gets the thematic thing, and he's like, no one can defeat the power of the ring. Like, it cannot be defeated by the will of man alone. You know, it's a very spiritual thing when you think about it. You know, it's sort of like, you know, without, you know, a higher power guiding, and it's, you know, he's a hardcore Christian, right? A Catholic, I believe. And you know, the whole idea of Christianity is like without the will of God and without Christ, you know, sort of saving you from your own will and your own stuff, that you're not going to make it. You know, like you in some ways that it's our best thinking that gets us into the horrible, you know, world that, you know, some can say we have and what we've done in our civilization, as beautiful and great as it is, like, you know, there's not a great legacy of us being nice to each other for long periods of time, you know? So anyway, back to the idea here is that, you know, the whole idea of the ring is that it is altogether evil. And it's the test of the ring is to whether the hubris of whoever is going to use the ring thinks that, no, they're the ones that are actually going to figure it out. They're the ones who are going to do it. They're the ones who are going to beat the system. They're going to game it. When in fact it can't, you know, by very nature it is evil and it corrupts whoever uses it for whatever reason. So eventually, and even as Gandalf says, over the ring, you know, I would use the ring to attempt to do good, but then over me the ring would have a power far greater than possible. And that's exactly it. Like, it's this whole idea also in 20th century of like doing things for the common good or the greater good. You know, you could say people like Stalin or Mao did, you know, things for the greater good, and they slaughtered, you know, tens of millions of their of their countrymen, quote, for the greater good, right? So there's this whole notion of all kinds of stuff to me wrapped up in the metaphor of the ring in Tolkien's books to start with. Here we are at the end of the quest. There's no one there to molest him. He's at the edge of the cracks of doom. He's got the ring and he cannot do it. He can't do it. You know, he finally and ultimately is corrupted. Our hero, the beloved little Frodo, cute little Frodo from the Shire, is completely corrupted. He puts on the ring and vanishes. And it's beautiful, you know. And Jackson gets it and reproduces it exactly. Because, you know, you could just imagine. You can just imagine that in any 9 times out of 10 people doing this, Frodo tosses the, you know, there's a slow motion of Frodo killing Gollum, throwing him into the river, you know, like the Michael Bay Lord of the Rings, right? And then Frodo very willfully taking off the ring and throwing it into the cracks of doom and, like, you know, high-fiving Sam. You know what I mean? That's sort of how we think about heroes and heroism. And, you know, at the end, the hero triumphs, right? When really, the triumph of Frodo is carrying it all the way. Like, he actually went as far as he could go, that he got it to the edge, but it was some other power that then was the last step in bridging the gap between the good act that had to be done. And it was not Frodo's will. Like, Frodo did not destroy the ring, and left to his own druthers, would not have destroyed the ring. So it's wonderful that Jackson understands this completely, that Tolkien sets it up this way. And of course, you know, he and Gollum are fighting and biting each other, and Sam, you know, falls down and he's completely despairing. Please, you know, throw it in. It's all gone to hell. And we have the biting of the finger, and Gollum finally reclaims the ring, and then all goes quiet when he slips and falls, and we follow him down into the lava, and finally the ring slipping off and slowly sitting in the lava for a while, the writing coming back up, and then just simply going poof, like a small little poof, and man, it's amazing. And it's amazing that Jackson got us here. Really, really amazing. Got all the way here. This event is for all the marbles. Like, in a way, this is why the Hobbit films really don't work. You know, they have this kind of epic filmmaking. And at the end of the day, this moment in The Lord of the Rings is for the world and for the souls of all of our heroes as well. And it's amazing. Cannot overstate how impressed, first of all, how brilliant Tolkien's last bit is here, and that Jackson gets it and pulls it off and does it the way, it, in my mind, it should, if you're going to stay true to the whole metaphor of the ring, that it should be done. So I'm a huge fan of the ending in both media. So now, you know, we really get the cream here, and we see this incredible slow-motion destruction of Barad-dûr and the eye slowly kind of winking out. Immediately, the orc and troll army is thrown into disarray, and they pretty much run away. And there's a wonderful soundtrack cue by Howard Shore, really just, man, you're just, you know, like you're forgetting about your popcorn for a while. The Black Gate and all the ramparts collapse. The volcano erupts, all in slow motion. You know, of course, Sam and Frodo were way too close to the lava. Most of the time, they'd be kind of dead meat, but, you know, whatevs. There's a wonderful shot where the camera's canted a bit, and we see them on the side, and these wonderful little sort of comets of lava balls are flowing. I mean, really, really beautiful. And there's a wonderful moment between Frodo and Sam after all this and after the battles and all this stuff, that it's just the two of them kind of hugging each other like, I'm glad you're with me, man, you know, and it's all over. Because they don't expect to live at this point. They have no food. They're out of strength. The whole place has blown itself apart. They're pretty much, you know, like looking at each other like, hey, man, we came this far. We did it. Now we're going to die, you know, and I'm glad I'm here with you. And it's beautiful. You know, it's kind of the soul of their relationship, which has come. They've come so far. And then we get a wonderful montage as Gandalf grabs the eagles and they come down and swoop and pick them up and off they go. So wonderful. You know, now we're going to wrap things up. We're going to start to wrap things up. You know, we're in the Houses of Healing, and there's a beautiful scene where Frodo wakes up and we get the reuniting of the Fellowship, which, you know, they haven't all been together. They haven't seen Frodo and Sam forever. So Frodo wakes up and everyone else comes back in, and it's a muted soundtrack, so we don't really hear much. We just see. And then Sam's the last one who comes in and looks at him, and they kind of look back at each other like, you know, not even knowing what to say. And then it's a bit of a stagey shot where it's like, you know, the members of the Fellowship are back together again, which is really kind of neat. So we get the wonderful crowning of Aragorn, a bit of a montage as he sings a bit. He now walks down into the crowd, and he walks by Legolas, and Arwen now is revealed to be there. It's this beautiful moment, you know, and Viggo really nails it. And they grab each other and kiss, and everyone cheers. when he's been walking by everyone, everyone's been bowing low because he's now King Elessar. And when he reaches the hobbits, they begin to bow, and he's very earnest, like, you bow to no one. And everyone around them, all the people on in Minas Tirith, they all bow to the four hobbits. And it's, you know, if you got a dry eye, I'm impressed, because it's a gut punch for me every time I see it. It's really beautiful. What Jackson gets right here is Frodo's look. He's not, again, it's not triumphant. He's not smiling. He looks kind of lost and a bit uncertain with all this pomp and circumstance. And it's almost something vital has been ripped out of him, which, unfortunately, you know, part of the price he pays is the ring takes something from him. It really does. You know, it takes a big chunk out of him. And when it's destroyed, you know, even though Sauron, of course, is gone pretty much forever from Middle-earth, at least that version of evil is gone. It also takes a chunk of Frodo because he wore it for so long and used it a lot and was very close to it. And you kind of get a sense of that in this, that, again, it's not this that the end of Star Wars where, like, you know, our heroes are getting medals and they turn around and everyone's great and happy. Something's still like, wow, this is kind of like a tender, semi-tragic moment, I think, as it should be, you know? So, really great. We skip the scouring of the Shire because we've killed Saruman earlier on. So, you know, in the book, Saruman leaves Orthanc with Wormtongue. He goes back to the Shire and pretty much corrupts the place and ruins it. When Frodo and Sam and the hobbits get back there, everything's dug up. It's all, like, ruined. And Saruman runs it with a bunch of men, and the hobbits are kind of slaves and prisoners. It's a really kind of bitter homecoming. And there's a great chapter when Frodo and the hobbits basically gather all the hobbits together, and they scour the Shire, and they kill all the men, and they wind up, you know, liberating the Shire from Saruman's minions. And then there's a beautiful moment, which unfortunately they couldn't do, where the hobbits are all ready to kill Saruman and Wormtongue, and Frodo says, I would not kill him even now. You know, he was great once, and we believe him in the hopes that he may find that greatness again. And we have this moment where Saruman looks at Frodo, like, with the text is, there's a strange glint in his eye. And he's like, you have grown, halfling, you know, because right before Saruman walks away, he tries to kill Frodo by stabbing him. But, you know, it harmlessly goes against the Mithril coat, which he still has. Wanting Frodo to kill him, he's saying, you know, you've robbed my revenge of its sweetness. You've used mercy on me, and I must go and be grateful. And I hate you for it, which is just amazing, you know, like, you know, Frodo's become incredibly wise in certain ways, and Saruman has really been shamed at the last. Like, he's, and I love that chapter in the book because it shows that, you know, when someone like him falls, like, there's a great fall, and then he just becomes like a nasty little bastard, you know, where just all he can do is try to perpetrate little nastiness on others for whatever strength and power that he has left in his life. And it's really just, I don't know, it's Tolkien really kind of gets that. He really kind of understands that, like, people like him are never repentant when they fall. It's like he'll keep trying to, you know, nurse his grievances and make people miserable as much as he can. And, you know, Frodo doesn't buy into it. He doesn't allow it to taint his spirit and his soul, which is so now beautifully pure after all this, you know. So anyway, they a brief aside to say they skip all that because, you know, they just don't have time for it. And there's a great moment where they're all sitting in the Green Dragon. And everyone around them is, you know, basically the hobbits. They don't know what the hell happened out in the wild. It's been untouched. And there's now a huge divide between the hobbits and their brethren. And they're sitting there at this table after being through what we've seen them go through. And they don't really know what to do. They're kind of lost. They don't know how to kind of interact with the other people. They're kind of just sitting around drinking. And then there's this wonderful moment where Sam gets up and finally has the balls to go over and ask Rosie Cotton for a dance, you know, like, I think that it's such a funny little in-joke where it's like, you know, Sam had to go to Mordor to get up the courage to go ask Rosie Cotton out. You know, just so funny. I think we get that in Tolkien. I'm not quite sure, but I love it that it's on the screen here. And we cut right away to their wedding. And again, you know, throughout all this, really we see Frodo kind of very out of sorts. And then we cut right to the Grey Haven scene. You know, we have this moment here where Frodo hasn't told them that he's going. So we as the audience don't know either. We see Bilbo now, who has aged greatly without the ring. He's like this tottering old white-haired hobbit. Galadriel is back with Elrond and Celeborn and Gandalf, and they're all heading over the ships. And Bilbo was granted a special dispensation, and then when they're about to go, it's a wonderful, really heartfelt leave-taking, which I think is right. I think, you know, the end of this movie is all tears. It's all tragic and sadness and parting and loss, and it's great. I know it sounds kind of goofy, right? But it's, again, it makes what they've gone through matter, and it makes it so much more meaningful that they're just not, you know, back home playing volleyball, drinking beer, you know, like it scarred them forever. It's not a costless journey or a costless adventure. Like, they've all been changed irrevocably, you know, and maybe Sam the least, you know, Sam's going to go back. And if you read the appendix of the book, Sam becomes mayor of Hobbiton for, like, you know, in perpetuity. And he finally goes over the Grey Havens, like, way later. But, you know, the other two, Pippin and Merry, wind up leaving the Shire after Frodo leaves. And they take up residence for a bit in Minas Tirith and a little bit in Rohan. And they wind up, you know, taking a boat over as well at some point to the Grey Haven. So anyone in the Fellowship, I guess, is kind of granted this dispensation where they can go to the Blessed Lands. So then we have this moment, the last moment, when Sam realizes, and the other hobbits, that Frodo's also going. So they're breaking down, and it's a ripper, you know, really just a tough scene. And we do hear, which is, I think, what Tolkien was getting at. He's like, I've saved the world, but not for me, you know. So really, really, really tough, sad, but great, because it makes the films that much more gripping to me. You know, it's not this fluffy little ending. So really amazing. And then, you know, we end up with Sam at home, just like the book. Well, I'm back, which is the last line in the actual novels. And it's the last line, I think, here in the movies. And we are done. Exhale. I just want to do a brief summary of, to me, the monumental achievement of Jackson here. And I think these movies will not be equaled for long, 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 long time, like, you know, maybe 10, 20, 30 years. No one's going to touch this. It was a miracle of circumstances that he was given carte blanche to do all three films at the same time, so saving money. But what a gamble. I mean, think about the gamble. Think about now how nobody takes a gamble on anything. And even when Jackson was making these movies, right, it was the early 2000s, nobody gambled on anything. You know, the movies since the past the 80s, 90s, it's all money. It's all about, you know, especially big budget tentpole movies. People don't take risks. Like, it's all incredibly safe, and they want to redo things. And you know, they gave this guy, I think it was like $300 million, which is probably the price of like the next Avatar movie. They gave Jackson this money based on, like, what, The Frighteners? Not The Frighteners, but like Heaven's Prisoners or something, and Dead Alive, like, you know, what they gave this guy, you know, it's like giving Cecil B. DeMille $300 million to make The Ten Commandments after he's made, like, you know, a couple of light comedies. It's just amazing, miraculous, and that Jackson really decided to just go to the book, that he decided to cleave so strongly to the book, and that he, sometimes that can be a downfall, which to me, the Watchmen film, right? When you cleave so closely to the source material and you wind up not even getting at what the thing is all about because you're so slavishly interested in reproducing it frame by frame, line by line, that you miss the whole point of the bloody thing and you destroy it, which I believe Zack Snyder did. And someday I may do, like, you know, my Watchmen rant, but I tend to like to not be a ranter, as it's so easy to rant on things, easy to criticize. But that Jackson was able to hew so closely to the book, and whatever liberties he took were so respectfully taken, and at the same time get at the spirit and the meta of the text, which is just astonishing. And continually, again, I think such a huge part of why these films work is that you had a director who was like kind of a horror movie guy. And what a horror movie, again, the idea of a horror movie is a visceral ability to shock and awe your audience. You know, you truck in all these devices. It's like why Spielberg, you know, and Sam Raimi for a while was a big deal. I think horror directors, if they have other chops as well, I think that penchant for knowing how to do horror gives you an ability to make a film very gritty and very right in your face. And this film rarely sands things down. Like, you see a lot of blood and a lot of viscera and a lot of nasty stuff that's just plain gross. And Jackson does not ever shy away from the grossness of it, number one. So when we have our epic big movie fantasy stuff, it's great, but it's also underpinned by such a dose of what looks to be very realistically done stuff in the screen, you know? So throughout the entire film, he never wavers from this, even to the very end, and it's amazing. And it to me, it keeps the film watchable. It keeps me engaged in what's going on because I never know what the hell he's going to throw at me next, and I never know how gross it's going to be, you know? He really had to beef up some of these characters. Like, you know, I'm a huge fan of the books, as you already know, but there's not too much characterization of these characters. The most characterization is really saved for Frodo and Sam. Aragorn doesn't get much, you know, and Gandalf obviously gets a decent amount. But, you know, Merry and Pippin and all these other characters are side characters. Legolas and Gimli are the comic relief, which, of course, they are here in a way. But they, you know, he builds up the side characters and he builds up Merry and Pippin to have a little bit of an arc. And he gets into Arwen a little bit more and gives her and adds, you know, takes away other side characters that Tolkien had and combines them into Arwen, which gives Arwen more of a you know, substantive persona on screen. Eowyn as well, you know, a little bit more Eowyn. The Faramir Boromir stuff really played up. They push it a little bit. The Gollum, Sam, Frodo stuff, you know, he puts some of it gets a little tiring for me. Like sometimes they do, I can tell they're doing kind of what I call fake drama for the sake of it. But, you know, they wanted to keep you invested in the film. And so they're continually changing these relationships and building them up and really not so much changing them from their original spirit, but just enhancing and perhaps pushing a little bit their original spirit. So also, and I can't even mention the Weta technical team, all the effects, like that's just besides the point, right? That stuff is great. But again, you know, if you're making a film this time in film history, like in a sense, it's kind of expected. Like that stuff just is supposed to wow continuously. And most films, you know, get the special effects right. So it's amazing at the consistency of how interesting the effects are. And again, another thing in these epic films, the battle sequences, you know, you got to have a lot of big battles in a movie like this. And Jackson keeps them novel because he has little stories within the big story. And he's constantly showing you how everything works and taking you from one thing to the next in a very, very visceral way. And building in these little moments into the big action sequences so you can follow along. And by the time you realize you're done, it's not like you're bored. You've followed a bunch of little mini stories within each battle. So, you know, I could go on, but those are the main things why I think this isn't going to be touched. All the performances to me are really amazing. I mean, I don't love Sean Astin, but I got to respect his enthusiasm for what he did. And, you know, he carries me at times, and so it's fine. And everyone else is perfectly cast. I mean, Ian McKellen as Gandalf was incredible. The Kings and the other big heavy roles, you know, Bernard Hill and John Noble, you know, these other big characters. And Christopher Lee as Saruman, like spot on casting with everybody, you know, everybody. So anyway, my multi-part series is now finally drawing to a close. I am not going to do trivia because that would be like another 7 hours. And there's, you know, most people can go online and Google your brains out. You know, if you made it this far, I congratulate you for getting through my multi-part series on Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings extended editions. Really had a great time talking about them. I really love these films. And I feel like it was time for me to kind of, you know, put up some numbers on the board about how I felt about them. So hope you enjoyed listening, and I will see you next time.